week on Retronauts, we discussed...
Hey!
Nice.
I couldn't even make it through the sentence.
You're going to get me in trouble.
That's why we have you on here. No, this is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 89. Yes, 89. And who are these strange voices you hear? Could you guys take turns and introduce yourselves?
Well, who wants to go
first? In any order. You, Evan. Go.
Okay, well, I'm Evan Birchfield. I work for Nintendo World Report. And I am an N64 addict.
Okay.
I am Chris Kohler of Wired.com, and I am a recovering Nintendo 64-aholic.
I'm Billy Berghammer. I'm a freelance journalist. Currently.
Yeah.
Still figuring it out. Want to figure out what I'm going to do when I grow up. Anyways, I am recovering. I guess that would be good. I'm a recovering N64 owner.
Okay. Still recovering.
I'm stealing that from you, Kohler. Sorry.
Ouch. Yeah, so as you may have guessed, the theme for this week, we're doing a special Nintendo 64 episode, like kind of a retrospective. And I wanted to get these guys on here because, well, Chris is just generally an encyclopedia of gaming knowledge. And Evan and I go way back on N64. We actually met on the Nintendo.com message boards talking about Ocarina of Time. And then we... Well, I started a Nintendo 64 website called The Informant, and Evan was, like, involved with that, and eventually he took it over for a while. And, of course, Billy is an alumnus from the very famous Nintendo 64 headquarters.
I miss that site.
It's still talked about today, you know, Billy. It's
legendary. Isn't that crazy? It's crazy, but, you know, and I didn't do a whole lot there, so I was alumnus, but I don't know how many things I did for it, but... You know, it wasn't to the extent of, you know, my later offerings, so... But,
it's on your resume, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes, okay. I mean, it would be on mine if I could claim that. But anyway, I think the reason that I really wanted to do an episode about Nintendo 64 is that it seems like lately it's been kind of getting a lot of hate. Like, retroactively, a lot of people are saying it's one of the worst consoles ever or something like that, and... I don't know. I mean, it had a lot of problems, but I think there was a lot of good stuff, too. Maybe we could start with the launch. Do you guys have any good launch stories or anything to say about, like, kind of the period leading up to the launch?
I have very little to say about the launch.
Well, say it.
I could say two things, which is that I was so young that people were... name-calling the Nintendo 64. It was like Super Nintendo was still the coolest thing, and not a lot interesting on my end other than the fact that the PlayStation had already caught on before the N64 was out. It was already dead in the minds of the junior hires that I was hanging out with. So that's about all I could say.
Personally, for me, like I was doing my radio days. This is when I used to... Before I started writing about games full time, I used to be in radio, and I was actually enlisted in the overnight shift. So I worked from like midnight till 6 in the morning. And this was like right at the advent. It was pretty much in the beginning of the internet. I mean, I think we were still running like Netscape 1.0, 2.0, that kind of crap. So on the overnights, there's not a lot of callers, you know, so in between song breaks and things like that, I was always surfing the web for more information about the N64. I was shopping around for a console. I didn't know if I wanted to get a Saturn or if I wanted to get a PlayStation or what. And then I remember seeing that in a magazine, you know, that when they debuted some of the first games for the 64, I was super psyched about it. The concept of Mario in 3D was pretty mind-blowing at the time. Mario Kart with 4-player split screen. Come on. Like, that was huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I held out. I didn't get a PlayStation right away. I didn't get a Saturn right away. I personally held out for the 64, and then I ended up, you know, getting picked up by the N64 HQ to be, you know, one of their writers. And so, you know, I was ready for launch. It was supposed to come out, as far as I can remember, it was like September 30th. And that was supposed to be their launch date. And I remember there were rumors that stores might break the date for launch. So I had money in hand, and since my shift got off at 6 in the morning, I went straight to the mall. When the mall opened, I stayed up. You know, for me, that was staying up. And I camped outside of a Software Etc. In the Grand Avenue Mall in Milwaukee. And I went back and forth between the Software Etc., KB, and I think they had another store, too. I was just, like, running around until, like, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, where suddenly, all of a sudden, that Software Etc. got a phone call from you know, I don't know who, but saying that some other store broke the date, and I was the second person in line. So I grabbed everything I could, which all they had, all they were selling was the console and Mario, and then I had somebody else pick me up Pilot Wings, which was the only other launch title. So I don't know, I was seriously, feverishly waiting for this console. I remember Blockbuster had kiosks set up with Mario like a month out. Toys R Us did the same thing, and I couldn't get enough, especially after, you know, people had imported the 64 from Japan, because it came out, I think, in May. And the import prices for the 64 were ridiculous. They were like $700 or $800 just for the console, if my memory serves me correctly. So, I don't know. I was really psyched for it, and especially seeing pictures of the launch in Japan with the lines, you know, of hundreds of people. You know, that ended up being what forced me to go to Japan for the GameCube launch. So, because I was like, that'd be really cool. And so, well, I did it, you know. But, yeah, launch was pretty awesome.
All right.
Expensive carts, though.
Yeah. Chris, do you have any good stories about that time?
For me, the Nintendo 64 launch was kind of this perfect storm of things that had happened. I had a job, which means that I actually had the money in the bank to buy this thing immediately when it came out. We finally had the internet, and so that means I had access to screenshots, the hype. I knew when it was coming out. And what ended up happening was, they broke the street date. It was originally supposed to be, if I remember correctly, September 30th. But then people complained because that was a Monday and kids would skip school. So they bumped it back to the 29th, which was a Sunday. But then stores at that point still had no... This was the first console, I think, that actually had a street date. Like, I don't actually think that that other game consoles had ever had a this is the day this is going to be available before. And so what ended up happening was the stores got the consoles, and a lot of stores just immediately started selling them because KB Toy Stores had no concept whatsoever of a street date. And so they ended up getting them that Thursday, again, if I remember right. And so now I was calling the mall, and then the EB where I had pre-ordered had them in, so we went down there, and I kind of like, I hadn't planned on buying Pilot Wings, but I'm kind of glad that I did, because then I would have only had one game. But for me, I hadn't bought a, what's up?
We were just laughing.
Oh, okay. I know, it's funny. But I had played Mario 64 in a Toys R Us beforehand, so I was totally hyped. They didn't have a PlayStation, didn't have a Saturn. This was what I wanted. And honestly, for, you know, Mario 64... it was great for the first couple of months, but only after getting 120 stars and realizing that I still didn't have any more games for it did the problems became immediately apparent. And I actually ended up buying a PlayStation pretty soon after that, mostly right around we got to the point when Final Fantasy VII was coming out. I actually do remember standing in line, picking up my copy of Final Fantasy VII, or pre-ordering it. I think I was picking it up. But the guy in front of me in line was buying it or pre-ordering it, and said very loudly to the guy behind the counter, "What I want to know is why aren't they making this for the Nintendo 64?"
Awesome.
That's a good question.
It was a good question, and I didn't want to give.
Yeah. I remember that demo kiosks for Mario 64 was the first time for me that they were a huge deal. And it was a round launch. It might have been, and they lasted for a while after, where people would just gather, and it was the kids, but it was also the adults. They were like, "This is new." I remember that very distinctly, and it wasn't just game stores either. It was like places like, for in the Northwest, Fred Meyer, which is a one stop shop, and things like that. People were paying attention to this kiosk and this new controller, which was weird.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Very weird.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, the Blockbuster, because it broke on at least the N64 HQ, I remember reading, oh, that Blockbusters were going to get them. So, you know, the next day I found out about it, or, you know, called up a Blockbuster near me. I'm like, hey, did you guys get a Nintendo 64 in for demo? And they're like, how'd you know about that? And I'm like, I heard about that. Like, we just got them and we're putting it together. I'm like, sweet, bye. And I, like, drove over there right away. And, like, the guy barely had time to flip it on, and I was already on that thing. And I just remember swimming outside of the castle for, like, 10 minutes, just totally blown away.
I think all of you guys were a lot more informed about what was going on at the time than I was, because, like, halfway through Super Nintendo, I basically just lost interest in the stuff that was coming out. And there were, like, I don't know, maybe 2 years where I really didn't play games. And I was, every now and then I would, like, check out an issue of EGM or something. It would have an article about Nintendo 64, and I was kind of following it. Like, I knew roughly when it was coming out. I knew it had Mario, and I was interested in it. But I remember being in a mall, and this was, like, probably three days before the launch was supposed to happen. And I went into an electronics boutique, and they had the demo there, and I was like, oh my god, I have to play this. And I'm standing there watching people play it, and I get to play it for, like, I don't know, 2 minutes before I get kicked off of it. And I look over there, and they've actually got the systems on sale, and I was freaking out. And I said, are you actually selling those today? And he said, yeah, they told us we could do it early. And I was like, can you hold one for me for, like, 15 minutes? And so he put it behind the counter, and I ran and got my mom. I was 14 at the time. I ran and got my mom and dragged her up there and told her I would pay her back for it the next week out of my bank account. So she wrote a check for it, and I got to take it home that day.
Wow.
Now, how much were games for you guys? Because I remember, depending on which store you went to, a lot of the launch games sold for either $79.99 or even $89.99. I paid $90 for Pilot Wings.
Ouch.
Wow. I paid $80 for both games.
That's pretty incredible.
I think Mario was like $70 for me, but I don't really remember. So anyway, it was an unusual launch, that's for sure. And I think it kind of gives you an idea of the chaos that there used to be before these really strict release dates, where now they have queues lined up and everybody and their mother knows exactly what day it's coming out. Back then, it was kind of a mess.
Right, but it was also the first. It was also the first time people really went crazy wanting to know when a system was coming out, because you didn't really see that for systems before that, because there was no street date, and there was no way of people figuring out
when. Well, Nintendo even advertised it in magazines. It said September... I remember the ad vividly. It said September 30th, dinosaurs will fly. And it showed Mario flinging, just like a picture of Mario flinging Bowser in the air.
Right. Which was funny, because they then had to back off of that because it changed to September 29th. And if you went in on September 30th expecting a Nintendo 64, you weren't going to get one. Which kind of leads into, I guess, the fact that the Nintendo 64, a lot of people don't actually remember, was really, popular.
Maybe
for a
year. I don't even know if it was that long. Yeah.
One holiday season. Yeah. That it was so hard to find, and everybody was trying to get it. It was like, that was the gift
to give. Well, I think that's why people now are and should be kind of skeptical when a new system comes out and it sells like crazy the first 3 months, because that doesn't necessarily guarantee any kind of future success.
Dreamcast!
Right. What if a new system comes out and sells like shit the first 3 months?
PlayStation 3.
Yeah. Really. Okay. So, I guess... Well, let's get into the hardware. I mean, what do you guys think about the hardware? Obviously, it was kind of a strange system. You had this weird controller and cartridges and a lot of peripherals that, like, weren't supported by more than 2 or 3 games each. Anybody have any thoughts on that in general?
Well, I mean, not putting a CD-ROM drive on the Nintendo 64 was, like, the big failure for Nintendo. It was their biggest mistake ever, their most catastrophic thing they've ever done.
At the same time, there's some significant advantages that Nintendo had over Sony because of it, but it was always, it was like the letdowns, the weaknesses always outweighed them. So in terms of loading and graphical superiority, things like that.
I mean, if I lost my legs in a car accident, I'd weigh less.
True that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were certain benefits, but... the drawbacks definitely outweighed them for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, more than space or anything like that, I think that the cost of the games is a big factor. You could get PlayStation games for $50, and eventually, as it became more and more mass market, you could get some PlayStation games for $40 or $30.
And
that never happened.
And the problem is, it wasn't so much cost of goods to the consumer; it was cost of materials to game developers.
Right.
They just didn't want to take a risk,
especially third parties.
Incredibly expensive cartridge that, again, they'd have to order them from Nintendo. There was this huge turnaround time. It was all the problems of the Super Nintendo and the Genesis. But Sony was just—it was almost like just-in-time arrival. If like you had a huge hit game on the PlayStation, it not only did it cost you less, but Sony could make you more of them really, really quickly.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about the N64 is that whenever you think about like the real benefits of the hardware when it comes to the controller or the eventual addition of the expansion pack or the fact that it had analog control or cartridges, is that all of these things, which I see as benefits in a lot of way, are also weaknesses. They're really twofold. The controller is one of those things that people will be talking about forever. It was one of the greatest and stupidest ideas ever that Nintendo ever had. It's got three prongs, so there's like five different ways to hold it, but you've got, at the same time, all kinds of new things like camera control. You have triggers, you have analog control, and D-pad, as well as an analog stick. And an expansion port controller. There's so many great things going on there, yet people couldn't get their head around it. You look at it and you're like, what do you do with it? GameCube.
How do you hold it?
Yeah. I know, so
you really shouldn't design a controller that people look at it and say, how do I hold this?
Yeah, the first, I only knew how to hold it because I'd seen, you know, in magazines how you hold it for Mario 64. My brother, who at the time was 15, went and played Mario 64 at Toys R Us with me, and the first thing he did was like grab the controller by the left and right sides and reach his thumb over to the analog stick to like try to move it that way. Like, no, this is how you do it. But no, it's true. Like,
which that's kind of what you do on the PlayStation controller.
Yeah, I have a friend who could beat me at GoldenEye by playing it that way, by reaching for the Z button with his middle finger. And he was actually able to completely school me at GoldenEye. He got good at playing it that way, and I was always like, dude, you're playing wrong.
That's bizarre.
It was an object lesson for Nintendo, and unfortunately the GameCube controller was even more of one, in terms of like, you know, getting people to understand something when they look at it. But I mean, obviously the analog stick was even more influential I don't know if the analog stick in terms of history is going to end up being as either influential or sort of groundbreaking as motion controls in the fullness of time, but it was certainly immediately influential then, to the point that everyone immediately jumped upon it.
Oh yeah, totally. And that's the same thing, you also had the Rumble Pack when Star Fox came out, and that was obviously a huge innovation. Memory cards built into the controllers, which
not the greatest
at the time,
thing,
I mean,
it turns out.
Well, it was good with certain things. I mean, you could bring your saves over to friends'
But your
friends
game
houses,
is like just twice just, the you know, size pop. Of your yeah, memory but, card, so what's the point of that? That was never a wise choice, I think.
Right. No, I think that was sort of a gimmick.
Yeah.
I brought my Turok save over, guys. I got to level 5. Nobody ever did that.
And of course there was the expansion pack, which it's hard to, you know, it's one of those things that I guess they built in the capability, as they do for a lot of their systems, for some kind of upgrade, and they never really intended to use it. And supposedly the story goes that Acclaim essentially forced them to release it because they decided that they were going to include a high resolution mode in Turok 2, whether Nintendo supported the hardware or not. And so the idea there was that people would buy the game and see that there was this mode they couldn't use, and then they would call Nintendo and bitch them out.
I'm sure that maybe somebody from Acclaim thought that they were totally putting the squeeze on Nintendo. I don't think Acclaim could make Nintendo.
No, yeah.
Goddamn.
Well,
Acclaim was extremely influential at that time. They were actually very successful, especially on Nintendo 64.
But the first expansion pack game was Donkey Kong 64,
right.
And it came packaged with it, and that was the Trojan Horse.
No, sorry, Evan. The first two were Turok 2 and Star Wars Rogue Squadron, and technically Rogue Squadron came out like two days earlier, But the that feature was announced after the one for Turok 2 was.
So how did that work? I have my history mixed up. What month did Donkey Kong 64 come out then?
It came out a year later.
You're kidding. Because no. That was the way that, that Nintendo got it into the hands of people for Majora's Mask, which required it, and Perfect Dark, which required it for most of the gameplay features.
Yeah, it was the whole issue with Donkey Kong and Majora's Mask and Perfect Dark. It was all really strange because, you know, Donkey Kong, basically you got the expansion pack whether you wanted it or not because it was required for the game, but a lot of people, including me, already had one because I paid for mine $40 or whatever.
Yeah.
The day it came out separately.
Huh.
And so then a year later, they're giving me one for free, and I'm like, well, great. You know, so I just, like, gave it away to someone.
Yeah, I have an extra one.
It was an
somewhere.
Orange box kind of thing, you know?
Gathering dust.
Yeah. But I,
Right.
Wait, one thing I will say about the memory card, even though I know you guys are crapping all over it, I don't know if you remember that Blitz in the arcade, you could take your created stuff and bring the memory card actually into the arcade, and there's a slot on the side of the NFL Blitz machine that you could put your memory card in and
it's
bring
totally
your stuff
true,
with
man.
You.
It, and it's a actually, cool feature.
That was kind of cool, but it was one game, obviously.
No, what I was going to say is that the thing is, you could do that with the actual game cartridge, like they did with Pokemon Snap.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really justify the existence of a completely separate piece of
art. And didn't they do something like that with Mario Kart in the arcade with Double Dash? There was some sort of weird thing there where you could bring in your memory card.
Yeah, yeah. That was with the GameCube.
Yeah, yeah.
So a similar idea, though.
Yeah, so it's this idea that, like, you know, it's like you've got this functionality that, of course, is never going to get used because arcades, you know, who spelled the death knell for arcades? Well, 3D machines of the 90s, so...
Obviously, it was a really strange hardware, but I think looking at N64, not just as a piece of machinery, but as a platform that Nintendo created, and if you look at the way that it was marketed, the way that it was supported or not supported with game development, I think there's some really interesting points that Nintendo actually still gets a lot of flack over, the way that they handled the Nintendo 64, because technology-wise, although it had these major flaws, they probably could have gotten around that if they just handled the situation better, but there were some mistakes made. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Square Enix was really the first company to go, but I think even more influential than Square Enix was the fact that all these other major Japanese companies, like, technically supported Nintendo 64, but not really because they just kind of weren't. They weren't supported by Nintendo. I don't think Nintendo was really going after them. And I'm talking about companies like Konami and Capcom, who are two of my favorite game companies. And technically, yes, they each released like two games on the 64, but they're ass.
Well, that was, I think, Nintendo realizing that they needed to approach third parties differently because they weren't going to get the content. Yeah. And I think you saw that coming to bear in the GameCube era, that they weren't going to get the content if they weren't either the first place system. But at that time, you know, it was still very old school Nintendo. They just had the attitude of, you know, fuck you, you're going to make games for our system, whether you like it or not. And really felt that, I mean, that had worked for them in the Super Nintendo days, but with N64 and PlayStation, they realized that it hadn't. And it's one thing to say, oh, we need to change the way we do things. It's another to totally...
We should be fair and say that as of 1996, it was not at all clear that Nintendo wouldn't be the market leader throughout that generation. Because the PlayStation was a very slow start.
And the Super Nintendo was still around as well, and it was still... There was awesome games coming out for it. Super Mario RPG, Donkey Kong Country 3 were late releases on the Super Nintendo. People thought, when they thought video games, they thought Nintendo. That was still the way it was.
But how soon that all changed, and just how dramatically it all changed. I mean, the Nintendo 64 did not do... I'm not entirely sure, but it didn't do nearly as well in Japan as it did in the U.S.
Right.
Nintendo of America marketed it very well in the U.S., but in Japan they lost much more ground to PlayStation and to Saturn. I think that may have had a lot to do with it, the fact that Sega of America just totally, you know, ran the Saturn into the ground in the U.S., But in Japan, Nintendo had really two stiff competitors.
I think
they
might have.
They came out third. I'm not sure, but I feel like the Saturn might have sold more
than
N64.
Not really. I mean, if you compare the availability of games for Saturn versus N64 in Japan, you know, the thing is there weren't really very many Japan-centric or even Japan-developed N64 games that would entice that audience. Yeah.
And you really couldn't do it that way because you had to go after
the N64.
Audience,
I think
to go after the US.
If you look at the top games and the top selling games, a great many of them, especially outside of Nintendo's first party stuff, were developed in America or Europe, and we had never really seen that before. It was kind of one of the early onslaughts of Western development into the console realm.
That's actually really weirdly true. I'm looking at my I made a little list of the good games on the N64 that I just love. Like 80% is American or European.
And that's a big change.
And it was a huge deal for Rare too, where they had become a second party, and they dominated the N64. Rare was the developer, from at least in my mind as a Nintendo centric gamer, throughout the 90s, and it was something to lord over the Sony fanboys, and then it was gone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Rare pretty much ruled the N64.
Yeah.
I think on average they made the best games of any developer for that system.
Boo. Okay. I'm going to totally disagree. And I'm sorry. I'm going to say, I have a total more hate than love relationship with Rare. My opinion, they only made two good games for that console. GoldenEye obviously being one of them, but Blast Corps being the other. And the rest of the stuff that they made, I thought was... Banjo-Kazooie, for me, was just like a very overcomplicated Mario ripoff. Donkey Kong 64 was the worst collect-a-thon I've ever played in my entire life. If I never collect another banana again, I will be very happy. Jet Force Gemini, I didn't think was that great. And Perfect Dark, I was not a fan of. So, I don't know. Everybody... You know, when Rare left Nintendo, everybody was like all upset about it, and I was actually fine with it, you know, so that's just my two cents on the whole situation. Everybody has this huge love affair with Rare, and personally, like, I think they made a couple of good games for the N64, like Killer Instinct will always, you know, I still think is great. Blast Corps was awesome, totally unique gaming experience. And I thought GoldenEye was good, you know, from a console first-person shooter perspective, but you know, every other stuff that they made, I really didn't think was all that great. And I know that they have an extensive fan base, but in my opinion, Banjo-Kazooie was like Mario ripoff, seriously, like with, you know, just over complicated controls and characters that I honestly hate that. Hearing that bear, like, seriously, this makes you want to puke. Like, I just couldn't.
I actually didn't buy any of the Rare games for Nintendo 64. I think my first Rare N64 game was Conker's Bad Fur Day, which I liked. I liked a lot, actually.
Conker
was good,
actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the gameplay was bad. I wouldn't go back and play it on the Xbox. Because, you know, I've seen it. I don't need to suffer through some of the terrible gameplay again. But, I mean, I thought that the story and everything was just...
I just oftentimes would see what Rare would do, and it just seemed like they'd steal a concept, something cool that Nintendo would do, and then put their own finish on it. Oh, I forgot Diddy Kong Racing, which I actually liked a lot. And that was, that was very much a Mario Kart ripoff, and... It was that I actually liked a lot, even though the final boss was just a huge pain in the ass whiz pig bastard.
I wasn't into Diddy Kong Racing.
I
at all.
Much prefer it.
And then when
it.
I played it on the DS, I was like, eh.
I prefer Diddy Kong Racing to Mario Kart to this day. And when people start talking about Mario Kart 64, it's like they're talking to me in a different language. I don't understand it. And Banjo Kazooie, I thought, actually perfected a lot of the necessary things that needed to be fixed with the Mario formula. And with regards to, like, in Mario 64, you can fall off a level and die at the top of a level, at the end of a level. You can just completely fall off and die. And Banjo-Kazooie made everything grounded, so you can never fall into nothingness. You were always just falling down and losing health. So I thought, I don't know. I'm probably the biggest Rare fanboy here, though. But I hated Donkey Kong 64. I hated it. So I'm
that was the biggest pile of crap.
I played all the way through.
God,
and got
I'm
everything.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I got everything too.
It was that. It's that mentality of, you know, this is the game. I paid a lot of money for it. I'm going to play it.
Yeah.
And I don't really have that anymore. But as a younger person, that, you know, I tried to beat every game that I had. I don't know, dude. I think Jet Force Gemini is pretty brilliant. I think it has some flaws. I think the platforming is pretty terrible, although it's not a very big part of the game. But that game is so influential, and it wasn't based on anything that Nintendo had made. It was quite original, and that game really, the ripples of its influence you can still see today with things like Ratchet and Clank on PS3, which is basically a clone of Jet Force Gemini.
That's interesting. I had played Jet Force Gemini too and liked it, but I totally forgot that I had played it and that it was a
Rare same
game.
Team that did Blast Corps and Diddy Kong Racing that actually made that. And there's like, at the time, it was known that there were three distinct teams within Rare.
They really did out games. I'm still looking back at, if you look at the list of games that they made for the N64 over the period of 5 years, it's
really
unbelievable.
Is. Yeah, I mean, they're now famous for these amazing delays and everything, and, but back then they were such a large studio that they were releasing two or three games a year, even if some of them were.
A lot of people left, too.
Yeah.
I think it's because Nintendo.
Right.
I think it's because Nintendo made them ship
exactly.
It. That's just me. I think Microsoft was like, da-di-da, whatever. You're geniuses. You make whatever you want. And then after, like, the entirety of the Xbox One lifespan goes by, like, 4 years, they make nothing. And they're like, okay, no, seriously. Yeah. All right, yeah. Perfect Dark Zero,
yeah.
That's going out a launch day. I don't care what Koreans we have to hire to finish the game for.
Yeah.
Is that what happened to that one? Okay.
Poor Rare.
But, other than Rare, that aside, the N64 had a few very definite strengths. I think it was excellent for multiplayer games because, I mean, and it comes down to such a simple thing as you didn't have to get a multi-tap for it.
Oh, yeah.
It had four controller ports built in.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So all you had to do was get controllers and plug them in, and you're playing four-player stuff, split-screen. And pretty much any good N64 game worth its salt had four-player split-screen. That was, like, the standard feature. That was, like, the Xbox Live of N64.
Well, that's the other thing, and that's one of the other reasons it was so popular in the U.S. is because of how GoldenEye took off, how Nintendo created the console multiplayer first-person shooter. Like, in college, all these people I knew had N64s, and they didn't even call it the Nintendo 64. They just called it Bond. Do you have Bond? Yeah, we're gonna play
exactly.
Bond. That's it. Just stayed in there permanently.
Exactly.
And they were all so much, better at it than I was, which is interesting because I was playing video games constantly in college. But I mean, they were all so much better at this game. That was the beginning of this weird split between, you know, sort of classic gamers and, like, the GoldenEye Halo people. Which, again, is interesting that Nintendo started this cottage industry, if you will, and then completely failed.
Absolutely.
With the game to follow up on it. Like, they should have leaned, they should have taken Perfect Dark, moved it off of the N64, and made that a GameCube launch title. I mean, it wouldn't, I don't know if it would have, you know, help them counteract Halo.
There's something to be said about the controller too, which is that the N64 controller was great for first-person shooters, and the GameCube one was not. And Xbox was better able to handle that, I think. That might just be me, but I don't think the GameCube controller was up to snuff.
That it's arguable. I mean, a lot of people think the N64 controller really wasn't that good for shooters, but developers just made it work. And I remember being really shocked with the approach that Turok took with it. And how well it worked. And actually, it worked so well that, like, when I would play things like Perfect Dark, I would actually use the Turok control scheme because it's closer to mouse and keyboard. You have free look, essentially. You have analog free look. And you can be more accurate, you know. You didn't need it in GoldenEye because there's so much auto-aim. But in a lot of the other games, there's not. And it's really nice to have that analog viewpoint manipulation.
Oh, so you guys were using D-pad for movement and analog for...
Well, I was using the C buttons for movement, but it's like a D-pad, yeah.
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 Oh, and
I see.
It seems strange, but I got used to it, and I think it's more accurate. But, you know, that's an old debate, and I'm not going to bring it back
up. Sure. But I think Turok is a very influential and important game to consider for the N64, since it wasn't exclusive. And it, in terms of gameplay, I mean, we had, this is an M-rated game where you're killing dinosaurs and people, and graphically it was really hot shit at the time, and the controls were great. Even though they were a tough sell at the beginning, Turok and Turok 2, what with the expansion pack, that those became this really, I think, important thing that caused, you know, we had also Doom, and we had Hexen, we had Quake 64, tons of first-person shooters on this system. A lot of them ports, but Turok was a progenitor for, I think, the rest of them.
Well, I think it was important to usher in the first-person shooter experience on the 64, you know, on consoles in general. But, you know, I feel like I'm sounding like this huge asshole hater guy, but, like, I mean, I came from a background where I played a lot of PC games as well. So, I mean, we had Quake 2, Doom, all those games that free look, well, Doom didn't have free look, but, like, you know, I was used to the mouse keyboard setup and the higher resolutions that you could get on a PC, and then trying to play games like Turok that were overloaded with fog. I couldn't, you know, I know you guys grew up with the using the C buttons as well for movement, and using the analog stick with looking, or you could use the C buttons for looking and all that crap. For me, I hated it. Like, I was just like, this is not what I want, and it didn't work for me as well as, I mean, it was closer to the PC experience, but for me, I couldn't deal with it. And I was really glad to see, you know, the second stick showing up on controllers, because that actually felt better and worked a lot better and gave you a lot more freedom.
Well, shooters aside, I mean, the N64 was also really good with 3D platformers. Obviously, Mario just inspired dozens of clones, and some of them were actually good. I mean, I like Banjo-Kazooie, and I like Conker, and I like Rayman 2, and there were a few other ones as well that were lesser known, I think. And then also racing games were, like, surprisingly prevalent on the N64. It never did have that Gran Turismo, and people were always wanting the Gran Turismo to show up on the 64, and it just wasn't going to happen. But at least with, I mean, not even arcade, but, like, less hardcore simulation-type games than Gran Turismo, the 64 had some, like, really, really, really good stuff on there.
Yeah, they had great arcade stuff. You got Cruisin', you have Rush. Those series were just thriving on the N64. Even though they...
Cruisin's not actually a good game.
No, yeah, that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. It's a terrible game. And I think we knew that back then, but it was there.
It was slim pickings.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is that, yes, the Nintendo 64, the games that came out there really defined a lot of what makes Nintendo great today. You know, things like Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask and Mario 64 and Star Fox and Paper Mario, you know, it set the standards. At the same time, you were waiting 6 months to a year between great game releases. And as a gamer, for me, it, like, wasn't even a question. Like, I would occasionally buy a new N64 game, but holy cow, like, I wouldn't have been able to make it without, you know, having a
PlayStation. Well, I think it also comes to the point where, as, you know, Johnny, you mentioned this before, gamers were a lot more informed. I mean, you could always find out what was going on because it was on the internet, instead of having to wait for the monthly magazines to come out. And, you know, gamers got to realize what Nintendo still does to this day, where, you know, they have an E3 or a Space World and announce a shitload of games, and then you get this total BS release calendar that you expect to have, like, 10 games in a one-year period. But those 10 games that they just announced would get trickled out over 3 years instead of 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember they showed off those screens of Paper Mario, like, so
when it was still called Super Mario RPG 2. I remember we saw the first screens.
Yeah. That turned out to be pretty much the last first-party N64 game. That came out in 2000.
Yeah, and maybe even later.
It was the last.
Yeah, because they released
Dr.
Mario 64, which is the biggest piece of crap Flash game I've ever seen. It was so terrible. I couldn't believe it. And it was cheap, but I mean, it was still terrible. But that, I think, was the last first-person release, or first-party release.
They were just trying to keep it going. And
wait until they sell you that one again on WiiWare for $15 instead of $30. Yeah. You'll probably pay for it.
Yeah, I know.
Sometimes go ahead.
Oh, for as big of a hater as Billy is being right now, I'll tell you, we sure did look quite a bit to try to buy him a 64DD when we were in Akihabara, which I think you eventually got.
It's sitting right here.
Nice.
I'm looking at it right now. It's still in the box.
Now what? Yeah, well, they're all still in the box because nobody actually used them. They just bought them and sold them immediately to Japan's secondhand collector market, which is where they just sort of constantly circulate now until dumbass Gaijin buy them for like $300 and take them home. Like, I have something I can never use. No, I won't. No, I refer to myself. Yeah, no, no. I refer to myself too. I bought one way before Billy did for this about the same price. They get the same store.
So have neither of you ever actually used it?
No, I haven't used mine yet. I was going to do a feature on it, and I never got around to it because I have honestly no clue where my 64 is right now. Like, I know I have it in a box in storage somewhere, but then I have to find that, I've got to have zero, so I got to get I've got like an adapter to play import games on the 64, but I have no clue where that is. So it's like a whole heap of, it would be like a whole weekend just to like figure out how to hook it all up. And I will do it, you know, I've got a little time right now, but I've yet to hook it up. But I just
need to get a Nintendo, because all my Nintendo 64s are in Connecticut and the 6040D is here in San Francisco. I just need to actually like get an N64 up here, and then I'll probably do something. But some of the games are still sealed. I mean, it's like they bought this system and they bought everything and then didn't even bother to play some of the games. They just played a couple of the games. They're like, well, this is shit, and they stopped.
Yeah.
The disk drive was a massive failure on the order of, say, Sega CD or 32X.
You know what's bizarre is that they ever even shipped it in the first place. I was absolutely convinced that they would never do it, that it would become the same thing as, like, you know, the reason why is they only actually shipped this thing because it tied in with this internet connection plan that they were kind of like half-assing again in Japan, where it connected you to the net and it had a keyboard and a mouse and everything. And again, I think it was RandNet.
Yep.
And it was just one more of their, you know, constant ever since the Famicom days, half-assed like internet implementation experimentation. And they released it. I have no idea why. No,
they didn't release that many, but they all did sell out. And I don't remember the total number of them that, you know, that they actually released, but, you know, it was it was a failure because it came so late in the life cycle and it didn't have a lot of support. And obviously Nintendo knew that they weren't even going to drop this thing in America. So their major N64 developers that were the so-called Nintendo Dream Team, you know, never did anything with it.
Did either of you guys pick up the sequel to Doshin?
You know what? The sequel? You mean like the expansion pack?
Yeah, it's the one that you play by pushing the eject button on the disk drive.
Yeah, no, I could have bought this if I wanted to spend literally $200. I could have purchased it.
Oh my god!
It's stupid expensive. It's so hard to find.
Basically, there's two 64DD games that I don't have, and they're the two rare ones. There's a golf game, and then there's that expansion pack.
Wow.
I've seen the expansion pack in Akihabara. It's so expensive. I'm not going to drop that much money just to have, you know, another 64DD game.
I honestly had no idea that it was that valuable, that it was such a collector's item.
Well, yeah, I mean, they released like two of them.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, since we've started talking about games, let's get away from the hardware and all the crazy stuff. And what I'd like to do is just kind of maybe go around and just take turns bringing up a game that you think should be talked about a little bit. And what I'd prefer is that we avoid the really obvious choices like Ocarina of Time and Mario 64 and stuff like that. But I'll start off with Rogue Squadron, which is one of my favorite games for N64 and really caught Factor 5 almost at their peak. They it was a pretty amazing technical achievement, especially in the music category for N64. I mean, I just played some stuff for TYP on Radio Trivia last week, and it's astonishing to listen to that stuff and think that it came out of the N64. But even gameplay-wise, it was just it was really the kind of game that I like, where you fly around and you shoot at things, and it's not too complicated, but it's very difficult. It's really hardcore, and the graphics were fantastic. It was, like I said, one of the launch titles for the expansion pack, and it was like, finally, we have a good Star Wars game for the console, because it had been a long time since that happened. Who wants to go next?
I'll go. Since we're avoiding all the obvious stuff, I'm going to say Mischief Makers, and hopefully it's not too obvious. Wonderful, wonderful early game. Nintendo realized that it was good, so they picked it up themselves, and they put it out in the U.S., and NX didn't have to do it. This was one of NX's games that they sort of tossed Nintendo a bone, basically. You know, we're making Dragon Quest on PlayStation, but here we will support your system. And it's interesting because, again, you know, you look at Square, and you look at NX. Square flipped Nintendo the bird and said, you know, forget it, we're putting Final Fantasy VII on PlayStation. Enix said, okay, you know what, sorry, we do have to put Dragon Warrior on the PlayStation, but we'll still make some games for you. And that's how Enix kept their good relationship with Nintendo and was able to make a lot of Game Boy games, Game Boy Advance games, stuff like that, you know, and that was the difference. It wasn't just taking the game away, it was the way that they did it. But yeah, and they ended up really doing a good job by enlisting Treasure to make a platformer for the N64, just use the D-pad. Whole hell of a lot of fun. I'd love to see this pop
it
up
had
on,
better.
On Virtual Console. Interesting bit of trivia about this. Anybody who's played it knows the main character, Marina. She grabs hold of things and she shakes them. That's one of her primary gameplay mechanics. And she goes, shake, shake, when she does this. So this literally was during the era of whoever happens to be walking by the recording booth at the time is pulled in and asked to do a voice. So literally, the way that I heard this from a Team Nintendo member at the time was, my friend Debbie, let's say it was Debbie, was walking by the recording studio, and they pulled her in. They're like, hey, Debbie, come in here. And she's like, yeah. And they go, say shake, shake into the microphone. She goes, shake, shake. And they go, okay, say it again. Shake, shake. Okay, great. Thank
wow.
you. And then she leaves the room. And that was how that was recorded. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Like, literally during the era of voice actors, why would we hire voice actors? We
yeah,
have plenty of people who can speak.
Yeah. No, yeah, I'm totally with you on that, and it's something that I try to bring up a lot on when I update the Virtual Console Mondays article on Nintendo World Report. Mischief Makers, I'm a big Treasure addict, and Mischief Makers is a necessary edition, and it needs to be on there. And it's a short game too. I don't even think it's got that much memory. It wouldn't be a big download either.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was like any good Treasure game. It's really short and awesome.
Well, you know, the problem is who owns the rights?
Yeah, that is because in America, Nintendo published.
Well, yeah, Nintendo published it in America, but the rights are held by Square Enix.
Yeah.
Who hates Virtual Console and will not put this game on there if they think they can sell it.
Well, they put ActRaiser on there, so is there...
They did. I think Mischief Makers might actually... there might exist the possibility of getting Mischief Makers on Virtual Console, because they're only putting games on there that they basically don't think that they can resell to you on a
yeah.
DS cartridge.
Well, and for that matter, Ogre Battle 64, I think, is a possibility at some point.
I would hope. That would be nice, but...
Unless they think they can shit it onto the DS and sell it for $50.
Well, they probably could, but I don't think they're gonna.
Yeah, I don't think it was a huge seller, and that's another late in the lifespan game. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Never
yeah.
say never.
Billy, it's your turn, man.
Oh, man. Well, I'm a sucker for Wave Race. Wave Race 64 was one of my all-time favorite is still one of my all-time favorite games. It's still way better. And Blue Storm was great, but... the original still, I mean, well, Blue Storm ripped off almost all the tracks from the original anyway. So that game for me will always, learning to ride the waves, you know, and how everything worked with that. They actually re-released it in Japan with Rumble Pack support later on, which I do have that copy.
I heard it's almost unplayable because it just rumbles constantly.
I thought it was fine. I thought it, yeah, I thought it worked well. And another game that I would honestly love to see on the Virtual Console is Tetrasphere. One of the best soundtracks, Neil Voss, I think, did that, and he did Tetris, the new Tetris as well. Tetrasphere was awesome, and it was also cheap, especially for a Nintendo game, and it was first party. But I think when it launched, it came out for $30, and
really?
I loved puzzle games, and I still do love puzzle games, and that's one of my all time favorites. I'd love to see a remake of that.
Yeah, Tetrasphere is really cool, and it's a little shocking when you start to play it if you're not familiar with the concept, because it doesn't really have anything to do with Tetris, but it's actually a pretty unusual and I think, as far as I know, unique way to do a puzzle game around a 3D sphere, and it's actually a lot of fun. And since you brought up the new Tetris, that's one that I had on my list, because I think to this day it's the best version of Tetris ever released.
I agree. I am 100% with you.
And it's right there on the 64. There are actually two or three versions of Tetris, but I think the new Tetris is the only... Well, no, that and Mickey's Magical Tetris were the only two that came out in America, but there were a couple others in Japan, one of which included a little clip that you put on your finger and measured your heartbeat, and it adjusted the rate of the blocks falling to your stress level.
That's kind of creepy, actually.
It is a little creepy, yeah. But... there you go, is a biometric game for Nintendo 64. The new Tetris has amazing music, and the additions they made to the gameplay were actually good additions and not shitty gimmicks like they do usually for new Tetris games. And it had this method of... It kind of stored up the lines that you cleared out into a kind of an inventory, and you used those lines to unlock new features in the game. And so it created this really addictive atmosphere in the game where you just kind of kept wanting to play, and you wanted to get all these multipliers and play these really long games because you could get all these lines.
And it was ridiculous. You would like be building the seven wonders of the world out of Tetris pieces, and you would have to clear all of those lines, and it would be like millions and millions of lines to build these things.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah, but there were multiplier effects and things that you could get to help you do that. But, I mean, it really fed into the addiction of playing Tetris for hours and hours and hours and kind of losing track of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it just it helped keep it fresh. So that would be mine there. Chris, back to you, sir.
I already did one.
Do you have any more?
No.
Is that the only game that you have?
Well, I mean, you know, we're not talking about, like, Paper Mario or da-da-da-da-da. You know, they're really... When you start getting into the... You're kind of scraping the... You get to the bottom of the barrel really, really fast.
I got
there's a
couple.
A lot of junk down there. Okay, go for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's some stuff that doesn't get a lot of cred, but...
If you say Chameleon Twist, I'm going to punch you in the mouth.
I'm not going to say Chameleon Twist.
What, you're not going to say... These wrecking balls? Come on.
No, no.
That game was awesome.
No, I've got... Okay, Castlevania 64 is...
Oh, barf.
No, seriously. Especially the way when they upgraded it to Legacy of Darkness, and it was...
Yeah, I will accept the Legacy of Darkness version because it's actually playable. I mean, the original is a turd.
The very least, the layout of the castle, the fact that it was a Castlevania game in the truest sense that you could go from one end of it to another, and it was fully 3D, it was the first time it was really done in a truthful way, I think that's really exceptional. Multiple characters, multiple paths. To Resident Evil 4, in its best moments, reminds me of Castlevania 64.
In the castle part, I can see that. But yeah, Castlevania was really kind of a technical mess.
Yeah.
Like, the camera was an abomination. But the music is some of the best on the system.
Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't it? They re-released it because it was so broken the first time they released it.
It's true. Yeah, and it's somewhat better in the second version. I mean, it's improved for sure. But like I said, it's kind of playable.
So I guess all the ones that I really like, I mean, I hope not all of the ones on my list are going to keep getting shut down. Another game I totally loved was Body Harvest.
Yeah.
Body Harvest was this amazing, unique, genre-busting game where it was aliens were attacking, and it was your job to go around and collect weapons, and you could it had a kind of a Grand Theft Auto element where you could get into any car you saw if you had the keys for some of them, but you had gasoline.
Well, hey, you know why it has the Grand Theft Auto element, right?
No.
It's developed by the same team.
Oh yeah, it was before. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, and that's another great game that they did, which was Space Station Silicon Valley, where you got into right. any animal oh, that awesome. You wanted to get into. And that was a puzzle game where you would run around a space station. These are two excellent games that have some technical issues. Camera is a problem. Slowdown is a problem in both.
Hey, look, that's for Grand Theft Auto fans, though, that's nothing new. I mean, even their modern games have those technical problems.
Yeah. Yeah, but those...
But the concepts are so out there that those games are really worth checking out if you get a chance
yeah,
to.
Yeah, those are exceptional games that I think... and I just love Body Harvest because it was huge. You only got to save at the end of every level, and the levels would be hours long. And it was a bitch to play that game.
Yeah.
Space Station Silicon Valley was a lot nicer. It had a sense of humor, and yeah, so those are two excellent titles.
Did anybody other than me play many wrestling games on the system?
I did WCW versus NWO World Tour. Did you ever play that?
Yeah. Well, that was the original, and it was good, but the follow-ups were much better, like Revenge and No Mercy were pretty... I mean, really considered still the best wrestling video games ever made by a lot of people.
Now, did I dream this, or are they bringing one of these to the virtual console but with modern-day wrestlers at it?
That would be insane.
That would be weird.
That sounds like your dream.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
That would be fantastic, but I don't see them doing it.
That'd be like the only wrestling game I'd ever download.
Yeah. Those games are absolutely great. Let me roll off a couple other ones here. Beetle Adventure Racing.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I'm looking at a list that I just wrote up, and I'm like, I can't believe I didn't say that. That was awesome. That was one of the most fun games where you looked for shortcuts. And I think shortcuts and just different secret things that, you know, that really, I think, changed a lot for racing games, period.
Yeah. Those track designs were absolutely ingenious. And they had so many shortcuts that your lap, I mean, you could go... take three laps around the track and barely see any of the same places on each pass through the track because there were so many alternate paths and shortcuts that you couldn't even take every shortcut every time because they overlapped with each other. And some of them were just plain hard to get to, like you had to do these crazy jumps and stuff. But that game has amazing tracks. I mean, there were tracks that would take 4 or 5 minutes to go around one lap. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Billy mentioned Blast Corps earlier, which is definitely one of my favorites. Bomberman 64, I think, doesn't get a whole lot of credit these days, but it's actually a pretty fantastic puzzle game. It has the best single-player mode of any Bomberman game by far. In fact, I don't even think they've ever come close. The multiplayer was okay. It's a lot different from the classic version. They were trying to bring it into 3D, and it sort of succeeded and sort of not. But that game actually is much better than you would expect. Winback?
Winback, yeah.
I really liked Winback.
Winback was great. That was, and it was hard.
And Billy's laughing, so.
My friend had it. I played it. I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was good.
Yeah. Okay.
It was sort of a light gun game without the light gun, you know, like it was all about precision shooting with the joystick, but and taking cover like Gears of War and stuff like that.
And it was interesting because you kind of interacted with the environment in a puzzle way, like you had to sometimes crawl along certain areas and then duck down other areas. It was kind of the N64's answer to Metal Gear Solid in some way. Of course, nothing like that, but... in terms of having to interact with the environment and shoot guys down, it had some of that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were elements of that, although it was a lot more crude. Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it so interesting you guys are talking about all these games that I've heard of them but never played them, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that N64 was also my really moving away from being a sort of devoted Nintendo fan. Like, I mean, back in the Super Nintendo days, it was totally okay because the Super Nintendo was better than the Genesis and did have better games, and, you know, Nintendo was making first-party stuff that was just on a higher plane of existence than much other console game software. But with N64, for me, it was like, I had a PlayStation, I had a Saturn, I had all these games to choose from that weren't even just, I mean, you know, I was importing PlayStation and Saturn games, you know, so there was just so much more potential stuff on my plate, and I was really only playing, you know, the absolute best of what each system had to offer. And past Nintendo's games on the N64, you know, past your Paper Mario and your Majora's Mask and stuff like that, I didn't really see any reason to get into stuff like Body Harvest or Wind Back or even Donkey Kong 64, even Banjo-Kazooie, if I had, you know, we were playing a lot of X-Men versus Street Fighter in college. We were playing a lot of,
it was a treat when there was a third-party game that came out, and for, especially for, I'm youngest of the guys here, and for me growing up with the N64, realizing I needed to get a PlayStation if I wanted to play stuff like the Final Fantasies or Metal Gear Solid, Resident Evil, knowing that I was missing out on a whole other world, was a really tough revelation for me, and it came like in 98 or something. So I had a solid 2 years, 3 years of getting nothing but these, just eating up the third-party titles, and, I guess they might be rough when you go back and look at them, but to me, I don't know. I don't think you can beat stuff like Body Harvest.
Yeah, I think Chris's perspective is a common one, because I think there were a lot of hardcore gamers back then who owned the N64, but they had five games for it, and they were all published by Nintendo or developed by Nintendo. And for those of us who essentially only had the 64, I had a PlayStation, but I didn't have many games for it. And I got it a year after I got my N64 for Final Fantasy VII. And other than Final Fantasy, I really didn't have anything on the system. So for me, the 64 is my primary system, and so I was exposed to more of these third-party games. And so that's why when people talk about Virtual Console, and I will complain to people sometimes. I'm like, you know, I can't believe they're releasing like one N64 game every 3 months. That's so ridiculous. And people say, well, they're going to run out of them so quickly. I mean, there was almost nothing on the system worth playing, and I was like, you got to be kidding, right? And, you know, I'll make the remark that there aren't any, not a single third-party N64 game on Virtual Console yet. And I think the consensus or the pervading wisdom is that there's nothing worth releasing, and I just don't agree with that at all.
Yeah, I don't agree with that either. There were a lot of I will say the best games for the system, obviously, were first party, yeah. Though. I mean, you can't get around that, but, you know, then again, you know, some of the third-party stuff, like you mentioned Ogre Battle, which is still hard to find, that game was awesome for the system. Oh, gosh, Rocket, Robot on Wheels, a great platformer. That was really fun.
That's from the creators of Sly Cooper and Infamous.
I think the reason, though, the actual reason why we don't see a lot of Nintendo 64 titles on Virtual Console, or why they are slower in coming, is that it's actually, I think it's really closer to making a WiiWare title than it is to making another kind of Virtual Console, like a 16-bit Virtual Console title. Like, they can't just dump the ROM. Like, they actually have to do a lot of development. Like, at Sin and Punishment, they went to Treasure, and they had Treasure port the game to Nintendo 64. Like, they had to, like, actually assign a bunch of people to work on the N64 version of this game. And that's...
Wait, why would they have to port an N64 game to
N64? I don't know if they're porting... port it to the Wii. But, I mean, I don't know if they're porting it. I think they probably are running the code under an emulator, but it requires a lot more tweaks. It requires a lot more development time to get an N64 game up and running. Which is why they're so staggered.
Weird. And
that's why we're never going to see the good
stuff. For the record, Sin and Punishment was actually localized for North America,
right,
and it was
right,
just never
right.
released.
Well, he's not talking about localization, though. He's talking about, like, technical issues.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know that much about coding for N64, but it seems strange to me, considering that there were very good N64 emulators as far back as like 2001
yeah.
that could run on my PC, which was a piece of shit. but I had a voodoo card or whatever.
Yeah,
on
but
it.
Yeah.
And if you had a certain kind of but video remember, card, you could emulate the N64 in high res, and it looked
but
great.
But it can't work 99%. It has to work 100% for Virtual Console.
Right.
And again, this is probably a reason why we haven't seen Majora's Mask as of yet, because we're still waiting for. You know, they probably have to work a little harder to get it right. I mean, remember the glitches that the GameCube version had, right, when they put it on that disc.
And that's an expansion pack game, too.
Right, right.
So there
might
be some extra layer there. I don't think we've got any expansion pack games on the Virtual Console right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's only a couple that they'd even consider releasing anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll see those coming up later.
Yeah,
but,
they'll come up with a solution for first party, but... There's like two Mystical Ninja games that need to get out to the people, in my opinion. and then we've got stuff like Hybrid Heaven, which is, you know, these are three Konami games that are never going to get any attention and never did, that need to be on Virtual Console because they're putting out such shit on the Turbo graphics. They're putting out this terrible stuff that we don't want on the Genesis. Why don't they go and get bang down Konami's doors and say, you can make money if you put out these games that, remember, you put all that work into them and they didn't sell? Well, we're going to change that around now. We have the opportunity.
I'm sure that they want to. I think it's a matter of Nintendo letting them and or giving them the resources that they need to actually put them together.
Yeah.
Or maybe Konami just doesn't want to, you know, expend that sort of like energy in getting that up. Maybe that's why we see only first party games so far on N64, because only Nintendo is willing to to put the effort in and get them up.
Yeah. Maybe the word N64 is just not even mentioned anymore, but in Nintendo or from Nintendo to the third parties. They just don't even want to talk about it. I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a dirty word.
Just Konami just plugs their ears and says, don't say N64 to me.
Yeah. No, why remind them?
Yeah.
Cool.
I think it's also a big problem with who actually owns the rights to the games and where... each of the companies are, like, Acclaim is dead, you know, basically. Outside, I mean, they're back or whatever, doing, you know, importing Korean MMOs, but, I mean, how does that work? And then you have companies like DMA Design, which is now Rockstar North, so, like,
well, the issue
I mean,
is that
it's...
So far, no Western publisher has been signed for Virtual Console at all.
Yeah.
And so they would have to be a Japanese publisher. And again, I mean, Acclaim might, you know, get signed up for Virtual Console or whoever owns the rights to those games, but all those games were licensed. So, I mean, Acclaim didn't make any original software for the N64.
Hey, Chris, who was the publisher of Super Turrican?
Sega.
Sega, really?
No, Seika. S-E-I-K-A. People, it says it lists Factor 5, but it's not... It's not Factor 5. Factor 5 wasn't even a publisher, first of all. And Seika was the Japanese publisher of it, which, again, is why we see it on Virtual Console.
Yeah, but their name isn't even on the title screen of the game.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if it originally was and they wiped it out. Because we've definitely seen where they've gone through and altered the original title screens on Virtual Console.
I don't think it's... I think we'll only... We'll find out if we look on the Japanese title list whenever they release Super Turrican in Japan. We can check there. Yeah. But the original Super Nintendo game was published by Sega.
Right.
Yeah, maybe it is Factor 5. I mean, again, maybe the rights reverted back to Factor 5 and Nintendo is just dealing with them directly. If so, that's awesome. But yeah. I'll believe it when I see it. Especially because I think Kemco Seika has released Virtual Console titles before, I'm pretty sure.
Kimco has, but there was Romance of the Three Kingdoms for Super NES.
I would be interested to see if... That's Koei. Okay. I'd be interested to see if they actually eliminated... If it used to say Seika on the title screen of the Super Nintendo game, and they took it off for the Virtual Console release.
It wouldn't be the first
that
time
would certainly
that they've
suggest
done that.
That would suggest that rights reverted back to Factor 5, and that Nintendo just dealt with them directly for the release of these things. That would be really interesting.
Well,
but also, American publishers are coming to Virtual Console because Activision apparently is releasing Super Pitfall in the U.S. It's on the ESRB list. Yeah.
Okay, well...
Which is good. Get fucking EA on this shit.
Yeah,
on,
you know what I'd like
Zany
to see
golf.
On the...
I
would love
football.
To see that Indiana Jones game that was practically a Zelda game. For the N64 that came out in 2001 and was a blockbuster exclusive.
That's Factor 5 as well.
And it was published by LucasArts, so...
of course.
Right, but again, they've got to negotiate with LucasArts.
Yeah, and I can sort of see that happening with the new Indiana Jones movie, the way that Konami and all those other, there were like three companies involved that brought Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for NES at the same time that movie came out last summer. But again, why bother?
Yeah, they're not going to do it.
It's kind of the same deal. It's not that good of a game. But we're totally off topic at this point.
Well, it's a fantastic example of how the N64, like, people started to get it at the end of the lifespan, as there were just two or three third parties releasing these games. They were releasing these very interesting, like Indiana Jones was, they said, let's do an Indiana Jones game with the Zelda formula. It had auto jumping just like Zelda 64, and it had the item selection just like it, and that was to me a good sign of support for the next Nintendo system. And of course that didn't happen, so
yeah. Well, actually, one thing I would like to say, and maybe this is kind of going out on a low note, but one of the things that really upset me with N64, and actually upset me about GameCube as well, because they just did the same thing again, was the fact that Nintendo and the publishers pretty much just cut off support for it once the new system was announced. And don't see that with PlayStation. You don't see that with Game Boy Advance and stuff like that. It's it was brutal. And I don't think I've seen that anywhere else except maybe in the case of Xbox, the first Xbox.
They didn't. Yeah, they cut off support because they were all taking a bath on, you know, prices of the. They were desperate to like get rid of the Nintendo 64 and never have to make a game for it ever again.
That probably has a lot to do with it.
PlayStation because there was still a market there. With Nintendo 64, had there been a market, that would have been fine. But I mean, there was no opportunity there anymore to make money, except for if you were putting out, like, you know, wasn't Powerpuff Girls like one of the last N64 games to be released? You still saw some people supporting the system, but it was only with big titles, probably licensed titles, that they thought they'd make a buck on. I mean,
I think there was a version of Tony Hawk 3.
Yeah, there was. There was Tony Hawk 3 for N64. And I remember seeing that and Powerpuff Girls in a Walmart, and they were like the last N64 games I ever saw there. And that was in like 2002, maybe 2003 or something like that.
There's probably
like
a Madden as well. Madden 2002 came out.
Again, if the people are there to buy it, they'll put it out. But Nintendo was very happy to be well rid of the N64. I mean, yeah, we're going on a low note, but you know what? That was pretty much what the N64 was. Like, it was just
out on a low note.
It came in on a high note, and then was on a sustained low note for about 4 years. You needed to keep one around because every year Nintendo would bring out an absolutely amazing game that you absolutely had to play. But other than that, it was just sort of taking up space and getting in the way of the PlayStation, and it wasn't stackable.
Yeah, that's a good point. But even though the system did kind of go out in a whimper, the sad thing to me is that like in '99 and even in 2000, the last couple of years of the system's lifespan, some of the best games for the system came out. I mean, even in 2000, that's when Majora's Mask and Conker and Super Paper Mario all came out that year. And that's a pretty badass lineup for a system that's dead in the water.
Yeah.
So it was just strange, you know. It was a really bizarre release schedule.
All Nintendo games
had it pretty. That was pretty much throughout.
Well, eventually they just had to ship the games. Eventually, it was either, you know, we're either going to move them to the GameCube or we're going to finish them up. We can't delay these games anymore. You know, delayed game, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Only bad temporarily. I forgot how it goes. But they couldn't do it anymore because they either had to shift it to the GameCube or get it out because they were done with the N64.
Yeah. And speaking of moving games from one system to another, it happened quite a lot with N64. You had Eternal Darkness, Dinosaur Planet, which became Star Fox Adventures, And I'm forgetting something really obvious here.
Too
Human was never on the N64. That
right,
was
and then
PlayStation,
moved that to GameCube. But yeah, I think if you look at the history of games that are moved from late in the cycle of one system to early in the cycle of another system, they never really work out that well. And you can say the same thing for Perfect Dark Zero and Cameo, and two or three other really clear examples of where that strategy, it seems to make sense, but I think the problem is the install base is so small on a new system that you were probably better off releasing a really polished game on the old system and just marketing it well.
Yeah. You get a game that's done in half.
Actually, the games that you're forgetting, you forgot Animal Crossing. That was actually an N64 title. That was released in Japan, but it was never released here. And Dabutsu Bancho.
Animal Leader.
Which was never...
Yeah, Cubivore.
Well, it was released here.
Oh, yeah.
Buddy, my quote is on the box. It definitely came out in America.
Yep.
But, obviously that game didn't do all that well. And Animal Crossing, it's not that it was moved over to N64. It's that Nintendo decided not to release the N64 version in America because they didn't think it would fly over here. And then eventually it was so popular in Japan that Nintendo decided to basically remake it for GameCube like 2 years later. And then they convinced Nintendo of America to kind of give it a shot, and it worked. So I think that's really sort of a separate case. It's a different situation.
Yeah. Animal Crossing was definitely... Yeah, it is really interesting that it got its life very, very late on the Nintendo 64 and then was just so popular they had to basically bring it over almost unaltered to the GameCube. But that was really that was a good wake-up call, I think, for Nintendo of America to sort of challenge their perceptions of what would and would not sell in America. Which you'd think that Pokemon would have already done that, but it's amazing how, even with all the evidence kind of in front of your face, you can still... make bad judgment calls.
Okay, well, on that note, let's wrap it up. I want to thank my prestigious guests for being here, Chris, Billy, and Evan.
Yay!
I really appreciate it, guys. And to our listeners, normal Radio Free Nintendo will be back next week. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this departure from the norm. But it was kind of a pet project of mine. I've really wanted to do it for a while, and I think it turned out great. And how could it not with this amazing lineup?
Yay!
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us, and we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.
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 Hey, Greg, Johnny, he said that we can be on the N64 podcast, man. We're going to be talking about the Nintendo 64. How do you feel?
I'll tell you how I feel. Nintendo 64!
Oh, yeah!
I can't wait.
Man, I can't tell you. I've been waiting for this for so long. I'm so psyched.
I was just like, Nintendo 64, it's just my favorite system ever. You know, the great sound processor it had, the massive library of third-party games. I was like, I can't wait to talk about this. I mean, how are we going to fit it in?
I know. I mean, I've been waiting for so long to talk about Quest 64. I just, you know, I haven't really had a proper forum to do that, but, you know.
Hey.
Hey, what?
Hey.
What's
James.
Up, James?
We're not going to be on the N64 podcast.
What do you mean?
He got... two guests and Evan Birchfield.
Who?
Well, who are the two guests?
Yeah.
Chris Kohler and Billy.
What's Evan doing on there, then?
Yeah.
That's a good question. He talks about, like, Body Harvest and then doesn't realize it's part of Rockstar or whatever. I don't know.
Wow.
Damn. Yeah, we've been sold out for two 64DD owners.
Man.
Oh, that's...
I knew Johnny was gross like this, man. I knew it.
What?
And then he wants me to edit it all for him.
Man, that guy can edit himself as far as I'm concerned. I mean...
Seriously.
I can't endorse a podcast like that, guys. I'm sorry.
I can't believe he'd sell us out like this.
Yeah, I'm...
But he did give me the okay for us to go ahead and do the Virtual Boy podcast.
You're shitting me, right?
Afraid not.
I mean, who does he think we are, man? Does he think we don't have anything better to do than this? The Virtual Boy? Come on, man. What next? Am I going to do the N-Gage podcast? You know, am I going to do the Gizmondo podcast?
I would do the Gizmondo podcast, actually.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I just feel like I got to, you know, I got to do something, like retaliate. You know what I mean? I'm not going to take this line down. Greg, what do you think, man?
I'm thinking insurrection.
So am I.
That's what I'm thinking.
Who are we going to replace him with, though? Evan Birchfield.
Oh, yeah. Let's see. So what do you think we should do? Think we should do our own podcast?
I say we should do our own podcast right now.
All right, boys.
But what could be our mascot? What could be the one thing that unites the three of us?
Just utter depression and rejection.
Lords, I've got a better answer. Thunder. Oh yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Welcome to episode 1 of the Lords of Thunder, unofficially unofficial fan club podcast.
Oh yeah. Lords of Thunder.
The only podcast devoted entirely to
Lords of Thunder.
Well, not entirely Lords of Thunder. We'll probably be talking about some other stuff too, but mainly Lords of Thunder.
Mostly Lords of Thunder, yes.
We might branch out into Gate of Thunder every now and again.
Ooh. Stay tuned for that, listeners.
So what do we got on deck here, James?
Well, first off, we're going to talk about some Lords of Thunder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After that, we're going to talk about some Lords of Thunder.
Okay. And follow that up?
Probably some Lords of Thunder. And then we have reader mail.
All right.
About Lords of Thunder.
Nice. Excellent.
And we're going to check on what's going on with the Lords of Thunder forums.
Mm-hmm.